Visit their website at www.livingyogacenter.net. Support for today's broadcast is provided by World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods at 6th and University in Champaign. For over 15 years, providing Champaign-Urbana with an international selection of cheeses, olive oil, balsamic vinegar, spices, chocolates, cookies, and more. Catering services are also available. World Harvest encourages you to join them in supporting public radio. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Theater Council. Presenting, David Sedaris, author, humorist, and frequent contributor to NPR and This American Life, live at the Virginia Theater on Monday, April 18th at 8 p.m. Ticket information at 356-9063.
Good morning. Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for our program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft, is at the controls this morning. If you take a look at popular media and you look at stories that have to do with health, one of the biggest, maybe the biggest story that we have out there today has to do with Americans and their weight. We are told by a wide range of public health officials, everybody from the Surgeon General to the CDC to the National Institutes of Health, that Americans are too heavy. And that if nothing is done, that we should expect to see a very significant increase in a number of diseases, things like heart disease and cancer and diabetes. This morning, in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with a guest that says that indeed, there may indeed be some relationship between health and weight, but that it's not quite so clear or so dramatic as we are often told, and that this obsession that Americans have with weight may indeed be actually hazardous to our health. That's the subtitle of a book that we'll be talking about this morning. The book is titled The Obesity Myth, and our guest this morning is the author. His name is Paul Campos. He's professor of law at the University of Colorado and has written a lot and spoken a lot on America's war on fat. He is the author of a weekly opinion column that appears in more than 40 newspapers nationwide and has contributed articles to a number of publications, including The New Republic, The Wall Street Journal, The LA Times, USA Today, and others. He is here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois. We'll be giving a number of talks. Just right off, maybe I'll mention two. He will be giving a lecture on this subject, and that will be tonight at 7:30. And this is at the Illinois Program for Research in the Humanities at 805 West Pennsylvania Avenue on the campus, and it is free and open to the public. Also, tomorrow on the 9th, there will be a book signing in the Author's Corner of the Illini Union Bookstore at noon. So again, if you're interested in meeting him, you can stop by there. This morning on the program, questions and comments are welcome too. The only thing we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief, and we ask that so that we can keep the program moving, get in as many people as possible. But, of course, anyone's welcome to call 333-9455. We also do have a toll-free line that's good anywhere you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Thank you very much for being here.
It's good to be here.
Just right at the top, what I want to make sure is we people understand what it is you are not saying, because you do make it clear early on in the book, The Obesity Myth. You are not arguing that there is no relationship between weight and health, but that, as I read it, you're saying that also people have gotten is that there is a very direct relationship between weight and health, that being fat will make you sick, and that if you want to be healthy, the answer is be thin. And your argument is that, in fact, that the studies that have been done, and we can talk about it in some detail, don't bear that out. Did I have that right?
Yeah, that's correct. The book argues that what we ought to be focusing on, to the extent that we ought to be focused on something in terms of public health, is not weight but lifestyle. And lifestyle has only a very indirect and fairly weak relationship to weight. And the notion that our public health officials are pushing right now, that if everybody had a healthy lifestyle, everybody would be thin, is quite false and, in fact, quite destructive and dangerous. And it's really unfortunate that we are in the grip of what I think is a moral panic and a form of cultural hysteria in this nation right now in regard to the notion that everybody ought to try to be thin. our public health officials have a ridiculously narrow and unscientific definition of what healthy weight consists of, when a person's healthy weight doesn't necessarily have anything to do with another person's healthy weight. It's perfectly possible for two people of the same height to weigh 100 pounds differently from each other and for both people to be at the appropriate weight for them. So part of the argument of the obesity myth is that we have this essentially false definition of what healthy weight consists of, and we have a society that is obsessed with thinness and which produces eating disordered behavior in epidemic proportions, and which causes lots of damage to people's health by telling everybody that they're supposed to try to be thin.
Let's talk a little bit. You make the case that, or you say that there's sort of three basic points to the case people make about this relationship between weight and health. That essentially the first point is that if you want to live longer, be thinner. That is, fat people die sooner than thin people. The second is that there is this relationship between being overweight and various kinds of diseases. And the third is the point that says, and the solution to the problem is to get thin. Let's talk about the first point. People now perhaps have gotten used to hearing about something called the body mass index, which is a way of coming up with a number that's the product of the person's weight and their height, so that you get a number that you can focus on. And I think that now, isn't that the sort of the ideal number supposed to be about 25? Is that kind of like the break point? If your BMI is more than 25, it's a problem. And if you're less than 25, you say you're okay?
Well, roughly speaking, the government says that you're supposed to have a BMI between 18.5 and 24.9 to be mm-hmm. quote-unquote normal or healthy. There are researchers who are even less ecumenical than that, as it were, who say that you should have a BMI between 18.5 and 21.9, which for an average height woman would be between 108 and 127 pounds. And I just want to emphasize that this is all nonsense. There's no basis whatsoever for thinking that you have to have a BMI within this narrow range in order to be healthy, or especially that you should try to have a BMI within this narrow range in order to be healthy, given that, first of all, the correlation between health and a weight is much, much weaker than would be indicated by these ridiculously narrow definitions of normal, quote-unquote, or healthy weight. And also especially given that there is not the slightest bit of evidence that if you take people who are larger than average and try to make them thinner, that this will be beneficial to their health. In fact, it seems to be quite detrimental to people's health to try to make them significantly smaller than they are. And therefore, this notion that we are laboring under, this misconception that everybody should try to have a BMI within this narrow so-called normal weight range is very misguided and destructive.
I'm sure that there's plenty of evidence. We have plenty of statistical evidence that looks at longevity and weight, among other things. When you do that, do you find that thin people live longer than heavy people?
Thin people actually do not live longer than heavy people. This is one of the many misconceptions around this subject. In fact, if you want to look at life expectancy as your primary definition of health, for white Americans, the low point in the mortality curve, that is the point where people live longest, is right on the border between so-called ideal weight and so-called overweight, that is in the BMI 24 to 25 range, while for African Americans, the low point in the mortality curve is smack in the middle of the overweight range, that is between 25 and 30, 30 being the definition for so-called obesity. So it's not true that thinner people live longer than heavier people. In fact, what you end up seeing is that you see a very wide range of weights, basically from a BMI in the high 18s, that is, for an average height woman, about 105 to 110 pounds, to a BMI in the low 30s, that is, for an average height woman, a weight of around 180, 185 pounds or so, in which there is essentially no significant difference in life expectancy or what physicians call or health workers call morbidity, that is the tendency of people to develop diseases. So this notion that thin people have better health than heavier people is to a large extent false. And even to the extent that it's true, one of the things that fuels all of this hysteria is the failure to take into account what is known in the epidemiological literature and the science literature as confounding variables. That is, to the extent that heavier people do have health problems, to what extent is that a product of their weight, and to what extent is that a product instead of things like activity level, socioeconomic status, dieting, diet drug use, weight cycling, access to medical care, all of these other things which have an enormous effect on health and which have a disproportionate effect on the heavier than average in our society because we have so much discrimination focused on people who are heavier than average.
Well, let me ask you this, because I think that some people might say that, yes, in truth, maybe we're a little nutty about weight and that the serious problem we have is not so much people who maybe weigh 185 and someone thinks they should be 175. It's the problem is the people who maybe should be 175 but weigh 275. That is, that as weight in Americans has sort of crept up over time, yes, the average American is a little heavier, but at the extreme ends of the range, we have a lot of people who are very heavy. And is that not a problem for them?
Well, certainly you can reach levels of weight in which weight seems to become an independent health issue, certainly at levels in which mobility gets compromised. But I want to emphasize a couple of things. First of all, that does involve really a quite small percentage of the population. When you hear that 65% of the population is overweight, what that means is that the vast majority of those people are people, you know, again, I'll use an average height woman as a sort of paradigmatic example, are people who weigh 150 or 160 or 170 pounds. We're not talking about people who are so large that their mobility is significantly compromised. And even to the extent that we are talking about really large people, it does not follow that the way to address the health problems of really large people is to try to make them thin, given that we have absolutely no way of doing this, at least no way that is that is reasonably safe. And therefore, to say, well, we ought to try to make these really large people thin is essentially to say, let's try to do something that we can't do and that in the long run is actually destructive. I mean, most obesity researchers will admit that, no, there isn't any way to make really large people significantly thinner. So what's the point of being focused on doing something which we can't do and whose health efficacy is questionable at best?
Let me ask one other question, and then we have some callers, and I want to give them a chance to talk about this. The second point that you in setting up these three points is saying that generally make these three kinds of arguments having to do with fat, and the second is that there is a relationship between weight and various kinds of diseases, and we have heard and read statements from the Surgeon General and from people who are in the public health field saying that we have a serious problem with weight in this country and that we should expect that if we don't do anything, that we're also going to see an increase in heart disease and diabetes and cancer, making the connection between, again, between being overweight and these diseases. And that's something you say data does not support that either?
No. In fact, we just had a new statistics released by the National Institutes for Health a couple of days ago for 2003, which showed that life expectancy in the United States is at an all-time high and continuing to increase at a steady rate. And furthermore, that rates of heart disease and cancer, the nation's two biggest killers, continue to decline. They are at all-time lows and getting lower all the time. It's really astonishing that people claim that there is a strong relationship between so-called overweight and so-called obesity and heart disease and cancer, given that according to their statistics, 2/3 of us are dangerously fat, and yet heart disease rates are lower than they've ever been. Cancer rates are lower than they've ever been. Americans are living longer and healthier lives than they ever have before. So how does this add up? The answer is that it doesn't, and that if you go look at the statistics, the relationship between these conditions and weight is actually quite weak and disappears altogether when you take other factors into account, especially activity levels and socioeconomic status.
Well, just again, to make sure the people listening understand where you're coming from, you would say that if we want to encourage people to be healthier, they should be encouraged to have regular exercise. They should be encouraged to have a healthy diet. They should be discouraged from smoking, those sorts of things. But that we are concentrating too much on just the one thing, telling people that, well, if you want to be healthy, you should be thin, and the solution to all your health problems is to diet, to lose weight.
Well, I agree that we ought to encourage people to be physically active. I think we should I have a little bit of a problem with the word exercise in the sense that I think exercise sounds too sort of formalistic and rigid and compulsory. We should definitely try to create social situations in which we make it easier for people to be physically active, since being physically active is clearly very beneficial in comparison to being sedentary. And I think we should encourage people to have a healthy and balanced attitude towards nutrition, which, by the way, very much includes not dieting and not obsessing on food and doing all the things that we're encouraged to do by the weight loss industry in this country, and that we ought to create social and economic circumstances that make it possible for people to engage in, broadly speaking, good nutritional practices. But what we should not do is tell people that if they want to be healthy, they need to be thin, since A, that message is false, and B, even if it were true, you can't turn larger than average people into thinner people. So it's very perverse to be telling people to spend their lives trying to do something that they can't do and which actually wouldn't be beneficial to them if they could do it anyways.
Well, I get one more question, then I promise the people who are on hold, I will get to them. I guess I can understand the weight loss industry trying to persuade people that they should lose weight. I guess I would expect that people like the Surgeon General wouldn't have anything particularly to gain by encouraging people to lose weight, other than thinking that that will help Americans to be healthier. I mean, if it's really not true that there's this direct relationship between weight and health, and we should encourage people to think a little differently and not be so obsessed with weight and only weight, why is it that people in public health are spending so much time putting out that message?
Well, that's a very good question, and the answer is complex. There isn't any straightforward answer, but just very briefly, for three reasons. One is because there is an enormous amount of economic pressure to make Americans be obsessive about their weight. There's a $50 billion a year economy that is focused on that, and that has political and cultural effects that go beyond the narrow range of the weight loss industry per se. The second reason is because we have an eating disordered culture in which people who have an anorexic frame of mind are examining this data and then projecting their anorexic neuroses out onto the data and then making recommendations that don't make any sense. And in that category, would include many public health officials, including surgeon generals, directors of the CDC, et cetera. And the third reason is that we have a tremendous amount of anxiety in this culture about overconsumption, and that anxiety is getting focused onto weight, even though weight is one of the most trivial forms of calories are one of the most trivial forms of overconsumption that we actually face in the economy. So we have a complex set of reasons why people are making really hysterical and unscientific claims on this issue. But after all, if this isn't a unique phenomenon, I mean, if you believe that when the Surgeon General tells you that marijuana is a deadly drug that needs to be very, very strongly criminalized because it has such horrible effects on people, well, that's a completely false claim as well. But it certainly doesn't stop our public health authorities from making it constantly.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Paul Campos, he's professor of law at the University of Colorado. He's the author of the book, The Obesity Myth, Why America's Obsession with Weight is Hazardous to Your Health, published by Gotham Books, and when will be, I think, soon out in paperback?
Yes, it should be out in May in paperback.
All right. So if you're interested in reading the book, you can seek it out. And if questions are welcome, we have several, and we'll get right to it here, starting with our line number one, and this would be a caller in Champaign. Hello.
Hello. I understand that the speaker is a professor of law. What is his background in the health profession and research? Hello?
Yes.
Well, that's a good question. I got into this initially because I was actually doing a conference on the Clinton impeachment, and I discovered that there was this tremendous focus on both Bill Clinton's weight and Monica Lewinsky's weight, and I was very curious about that and trying to figure out why were people so obsessive about the bodies and the weight of the people involved in the Clinton impeachment. And what I discovered essentially was what I think of as a kind of whistleblowing project that I've ended up undertaking, which is that we are in the grip of this kind of cultural hysteria and moral panic. And one of the main points of the book is that weight and body image and related issues have been inappropriately medicalized in this culture. So the claim is made, you know, you have to trust your doctor about this issue, when in fact your doctor usually is somebody who knows very, very little about these issues, because your doctor is somebody who's an expert in renal failure or lung cancer or dermatology or what have you. And the people who are actually giving advice on this issue are, A, obesity researchers who obviously have an extremely strong vested interest in pathologizing weight and treating it as – or higher than average weight and treating it as a disease, and, B, the weight loss industry, who obviously – even more obviously, I should say – have a tremendously vested interest in turning this into a medical and medicalized issue. Essentially, the public health authorities in this country are telling us that two-thirds of us have a disease – the disease of weighing too much. The book is, I think, a very straightforward critique of that claim, which is just almost completely false. Now, in fact, a lot of medical personnel agree with me about that, by the way. And one of the things that I discovered in my research is that there are many, many critics of our weight hysteria in the health professions and also in many other disciplines, sociologists, anthropologists, political scientists, psychologists, and especially eating disorder specialists.
Okay, so I'm just trying to understand, how are you qualified to give me advice?
Well, I'm qualified to give you advice by advising you to actually look at the evidence for yourself and make up your own mind, as opposed to implicitly believing people who are telling you that if you look long enough for weapons of body mass destruction, you're going to find them, even though we have a 100-year history of failing to find the weapons of body mass destruction. And the advice you're getting from those people is, well, just keep on looking, because the advice that hasn't worked for the last 100 years apparently is going to work at some point in the future, although they can give no explanation whatsoever as to why it would ever work.
Okay, thank you.
All right, let's go to the next caller. This would be someone in Urbana, line 2.
Yes.
Hello? Yes.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I have to turn my phone up. I think your thesis is fascinating. I have a 10-year-old granddaughter, and I was looking at a bunch of jeans that were folded up and put aside. And I said, oh, are these jeans that you're going to put in your drawers, or are they jeans that your mom is passing on? And she said, well, I used to wear them, but now I'm too fat. And I said, honey, you're not fat. You're just growing. You're supposed to grow. That's what kids are supposed to do. And, of course, the clothes that you wore last year aren't going to fit you this year. So that was pretty appalling. I thought, 10 and already she's talking about getting fat. So in many ways, I totally agree with you. And on the other hand, I weigh about 250, and I'm only 5'4.5". And I have arthritis, and they tell me that my knees wouldn't hurt so much if I lost weight. And that seems like a realistic cause and effect on my part. And I do try to emphasize exercise, and I don't count my calories and things of that sort. So I think there's sometimes when dropping weight, not getting skinnier, but dropping weight might be appropriate.
Well, yeah, I'd like to say a couple of things. One is in response to your first point. Approximately one half of the 10-year-old girls in this country at this time either are on or have been on a diet, which I think is a really disastrous commentary on the invidiousness of this diet culture and the very destructive effects it has on our youngsters. I mean, what is it telling us? What is it telling 10-year-old girls when the message they're getting is that the most important thing they can do is to dedicate a significant portion of their energies and talents to trying to fit into this very narrow definition of a so-called ideal weight? I mean, I think that's terribly destructive both psychologically and physiologically. As to the second point in regard to your own weight and arthritis in your knees, it's true that people who are significantly heavier than average are going to be prone to certain kinds of illnesses that they wouldn't necessarily be prone to if they were not significantly heavier than average. But people who are significantly thinner than average are going to be prone to certain kinds of diseases that they would not be prone to if they were not. So, for example, osteoporosis is far, far more commonplace among thin women than it is among fat women, and osteoporosis is obviously a very serious kind of syndrome. Now, as to the practical question of one, what one ought to do, I think the medical research very strongly suggests that somebody who, for example, is sedentary and eats a high-fat, high-sugar diet will benefit from becoming moderately physically active and perhaps eating a diet that's rich in fruits and vegetables and has a lot of fiber in it. Now, this will not produce significant long-term weight loss in the vast majority of cases, but it will produce better health in regard to people who move from a less healthy to a more healthy lifestyle. If you're already living a healthy lifestyle, then you are a large person by genetic and environmental inheritance. And it's true that there are certain physiological disadvantages associated with that. But for example, there are tremendous physiological disadvantages associated with being male as opposed to female in terms of health. But we don't take from that the lesson that we ought to try to turn men into women. And so I would suggest that, you know, people who are significantly larger than average and who already have a healthy lifestyle recognize that they are simply significantly larger than average people.
I have a personal question, if I may. And would you consider yourself a chunky person, a large person, in terms of your own physical stance? You know, how would you describe your physical body?
Well, currently, I mean, I think that's a perfectly fair question because it's one that I always ask obesity researchers to tell me what their body mass index is. Because after all, I think, you know, this advice, if the kind of advice that they're giving ought to be applied to themselves, certainly. I myself right now am culturally typed as basically fairly thin in most social contexts. I'm 5'8" and weigh about 165 pounds, but I'm very physically active. I run a lot. And as a middle-aged male, I'm considered basically, in most contexts, somewhat thin, although in Boulder, Colorado, where I live, I'm not considered thin because everyone is so thin there. But in any case, nevertheless, I'm right on the borderline of being overweight. I probably am overweight at this moment because I had breakfast this morning, which is just another example of how absurdly restrictive these standards are, that someone such as myself, who runs 40 miles a week, is in excellent health and is considered aesthetically thin by most people, or at least you know, certainly not by any means fat, is nevertheless labeled overweight by a government and a medical establishment that has these frankly crazy definitions.
Thank you. This has been a really enlightening conversation.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. We have some other calls, and we'll get to in a second. Let me introduce again our guest, Paul Campos. He's the author of the book, The Obesity Myth, Why America's Obsession with Weight is Hazardous to Your Health, published by Gotham Books. It's now available in hardcover and soon in the paperback. He is professor of law at the University of Colorado and has done a lot of writing and speaking on this subject, America's War on Fat. He will be giving a public lecture dealing with these subjects tonight at 7:30 on the U of I campus at the Illinois Program for Research in the Humanities at 805 West Pennsylvania, and it is free and open to the public if you would like to attend. Also, there'll be a panel discussion on the issue of weight and how it's discussed in the media. That's on Wednesday, 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Thursday, 1 o'clock in the afternoon, a panel discussion on issues of race and fat. And then he also will be doing a book signing tomorrow at the Illini Union Bookstore in the Author's Corner at noon. And on any and all of those things, you should feel welcome to attend. Questions, welcome to 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL or 9455. The first caller earlier was nice enough not to ask it this way, but I would expect that probably a lot of people come up to you and say, well, what do you know? You're a professor of law. You're not a doctor. Why should we believe what you have to say about essentially what is a medical subject? And you no doubt have to respond to that a lot.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And one of the things I try to emphasize, two things in regard to that point. One is that there are a great number of people in the medical profession, physicians and other medical academics and other healthcare workers, who agree with everything that I'm saying in this book and emphasize the very same things that I do and are sick and tired of hearing the same nonsense being jammed down the throats of their patients and jammed down the throats of the medical profession. I mean, doctors are like anyone else. They don't like to be told to do things which are impossible for them to do. And when they're told, make your patients thin, they're being told to do something that they cannot do. If the medical science has established anything, it is the following. Telling people to reduce caloric intake and increase activity levels in order to produce weight loss does not work. That has been proven through literally billions of instantiations over the course of the last 100 years or so, ever since we became obsessed with this issue. And so basically we're telling doctors to do something which they themselves know from their own clinical practice does not work. And so they are very happy quite often to hear an alternative viewpoint on this. The second thing I want to emphasize is that what we have done in this culture is to inappropriately medicalize the concept of weight and the concept of body image. To say that doctors are the only people who are culturally authorized to talk about this is precisely to beg the question. It is to treat something which in many ways has nothing to do with health or medicine, but is rather a political and cultural and social issue, as if it were nothing but a straightforward medical issue any other, when in fact it's not at all. It is in fact something which to a great extent is an issue that has nothing to do with medicine but has been inappropriately medicalized. When you treat people who are perfectly normal and have healthy lifestyles as if they have a disease simply because they don't fit inside some very narrow and unscientific definition of ideal weight, what you are doing is you are inappropriately medicalizing an issue. And that's why it's so important for people both in and out of the medical profession to criticize our obsession with weight and our inappropriate pathologizing of two-thirds of the American population.
Let's get back to the phones here. Line 3 is next. Someone here locally in Champaign-Urbana. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Interesting. Please comment on some items in the news recently and or what you'd suggest as remedies or what's called discrimination. Like the news said at a casino, the personnel had to be thin to keep their jobs. And the paper questioned whether this was, strictly legal. Then some people weighing about 280 and 400 pounds had to buy second tickets on airlines, and they didn't like that. And the third, smokers in Michigan, were told they'd lose their jobs if they didn't stop smoking. So now there's a lawmaker trying to pass a law that prevents that. So please comment. Ciao.
Okay.
Sure. It's important to understand that, first of all, there is almost no legal protection based on body size in this country. There are only a very few places in this country where it's illegal to discriminate on the basis of body size. It's basically legal in 99.5% of America. And when you understand that body size is to a large extent, to in fact the greatest extent, something that is not alterable for most people in the long term, then it becomes clear that discriminating on the basis of body size is very similar to discriminating on the basis of any unalterable physical characteristic. And since most people believe that, and in fact in most instances it's illegal to discriminate on the basis of some unalterable physical characteristic, I think we should be very, very disturbed by the notion that we allow both businesses and the government to discriminate on the basis of body size when body size is something that most people cannot significantly change in the long run. The comparison with smoking, I think, is problematic because we have to remember smoking is a behavior. And I'm not saying that there isn't anything problematic against discriminating against people on the basis of whether they smoke or not, because I do think there are problematic aspects of that. But we must remember that while smoking is a behavior, so-called overweight and obesity are not behaviors. They are body states. They are to a great extent part of the natural variation of human diversity in regard to physical characteristics. And we should not buy into the fundamental myth that people who are fat can be thin. That, almost without exception, simply is not true. On the other hand, it is quite often possible for people who are smokers to become not non-smokers because it's a much more straightforward kind of question, because you're dealing with the behavior rather than in what in many ways is an unalterable physical characteristic. And one of the things that fuels so much of this hysteria is this myth that people could be thin if they chose to be. I mean, if that were true, there would be no fat people in America. If shaming fat people about their bodies made people thin, there would be no fat people in America. If discriminating against fat people on the basis of their bodies made people thin, there would be no fat people in America. And I think it is actually quite disgraceful that we allow ourselves to discriminate against people on the basis of physically what is in many ways a physically inalterable set of characteristics.
It seems to me, though, that as long as being overweight is as stigmatized as it is, giving somebody a message that says fat people are born fat people, it got to be pretty discouraging.
Well, I don't think it's discouraging because I personally think that it is much more discouraging to be told a set of lies that you could be thin if you tried hard enough. That's what's really discouraging, because what we end up doing in this culture is we end up blaming people for things that there's nothing that they can really do about in the long run. And that, I think, is much more detrimental than saying to people, if you have a healthy lifestyle, you will be healthier than somebody who does not. Whether you're fat and they're thin, or both of you are fat or both of you are thin or what have you. What matters is lifestyle. And, of course, lifestyle does have some effect on weight on the margin, but it's a relatively mild or marginal kind of an effect. Most people who are larger than average will continue to be larger than average no matter what they do. And, by the way, most people who are thin are going to be thin no matter what they do. There are millions of thin Americans who have terrible lifestyles in terms of health. And very often, in fact, they maintain their thinness by doing things that are bad for their health, such as, for example, smoking or engaging in eating disordered behavior or compulsive exercise or what have you, things that can be quite detrimental to health. And yet the message that they get from the culture is you're thin, so everything is fine, which is also a very destructive message for them to get.
Okay, let's go to Urbana next, line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I may have missed it since I've come in late, but it helps me to begin at the beginning. The data that gives rise to, say, tables of height and weight, is that based on the way things used to be? That is, some actuary actually got a list of thousands and thousands of people and did a spread of height and weight, and it was basically assumed this is the way it ought to be because right now, when the data was collected, this is the way things are. Or have there been other sources of the data for height-weight distributions? It would help a lot if we sort of started at the beginning and found out whether this was based on a snapshot or a distorted data gathering. Could you speak to that, please?
Oh, absolutely. And there's a fascinating social history here. The way this all started, to go back to the beginning, as you say, is the 1920s and 30s. There was a man at the Metropolitan Life Insurance Company named Lewis Dublin who became obsessed with the notion that thinness was better than fatness and that you would be able to predict mortality on the basis of whether insurance policyholders were thin or fat, which, of course, would be a very beneficial thing in terms of the economics of life insurance. The only problem with this is that his theory was completely false. He put together these height-weight tables, which were constructed in the most unscientific way imaginable and which never, in fact, correlated with mortality risk in any meaningful way. One of the big secrets of the famous MetLife tables, which all of us who are of a certain age can remember from the 1960s and 70s, is that the Metropolitan Life Insurance Company never used its own tables for the purposes of pricing insurance. So the actuarial value of these things was essentially nil, and yet they became this kind of gospel, which has now been replaced by the government's body mass index tables, which, again, if you actually look at them, do not correlate in any kind of meaningful way with health risk, except at really at real statistical extremes. And so one of the most striking aspects of all this is that the data simply does not support the recommendations that are being put forth, either by life insurance companies traditionally or by the government now.
So what we're discussing is a real fact, though. People did do data on what existed, that they didn't bias the data. They'd said 97% of people are less than this weight, 95% are less than this weight, 90% less than this weight. Are those data historically factual, as far as you can tell?
Well,
it's a snapshot of the way things actually work.
Well, the snapshot, as a descriptive matter, was somewhat accurate if you're just talking about life insurance policyholders, who, of course, were a very limited sector of the population as a whole, much wealthier than average.
Data on the general census population?
Well, no one ever really did that in terms of the general census until relatively recently.
So that, again, is just a snapshot of the way things are rather than predictive.
Well, right. I mean, you know, the long-term predictive studies that have been done on this show essentially that when you take other kinds of factors into account, Weight has basically no value in terms of predicting life expectancy and health except at real statistical extremes. And in particular, the government's definition of healthy weight, which is very narrow and which some people are trying to narrow even more now in this field, does not have any scientific credibility. And this is, I mean, I realize that this is kind of a shocking conclusion and one which people naturally will resist. But
people who have dealt with the history of, say, IQ and IQ testing know that for the best of motives, strange things get put on paper.
Well, you're absolutely correct about that. And I think one of the things that people who are familiar with, for example, the history of science and the sociology of science will recognize is that the story that I'm laying out in this book is not a unique one. It has taken place in other contexts as well.
May I ask another question?
Well, we're really short on time, and I have
a lot
of other callers.
I
appreciate you indulging. Let's go to line number four, and this is someone in Chicago. Hello.
Hello, Mr. Campos. I read your book last year, and it was the most one of the most important books I read last year. I really congratulate you on writing that because I think that it would be very hard for people in public health to write it because there's almost a mass hypnotism or mass delusion that goes on. And you are absolutely right. Unfortunately, many people who go into nutrition and dietetics have eating disorders. And because of that, their viewpoint of weight and their almost phobia about weight, I think, really does reflect in the research and how they interpret research. One of the comments, though, that you talk about in the book and you haven't had a chance to talk about now is how the discrimination against people who are overweight, unfortunately, also correlates with discrimination against race. And I just wanted to point out to you one thing that irritates me. There's a commercial for Universal Studios where they show this grossly overweight black woman, and you realize that if they had put her in an Aunt Jemima outfit, people would be protesting all over. But because they have her just simply overweight, I guess many people don't see that this is obviously, again, a racial slur.
Well, there is a very interesting and disturbing intersection between race prejudice and also class prejudice and weight. There is an inverse correlation in this culture between weight and socioeconomic status. In other words, the heavier you are, the more likely you are to be poor, and the thinner you are, the more likely you are to be rich, generalizing, of course. This correlation also tracks, to some extent, ethnicity. So, for example, working-class whites tend to be about the same weight as African-Americans and Latinos in general. And I think it is not coincidental that the obsession that our public health authorities have developed on this issue and the irrationality of it and the junk science that fuels it also helps fuel a lot of traditional prejudices in terms of race and ethnicity and social class. To be overly reductive, but to make an argument which is made with more nuance in the book itself, I think a lot of what you have here are thin, upper-class white people projecting their neuroses out onto larger, poorer people who are often people of color. And I think the underlying sociological and political reasons for that kind of projection are very disturbing and something that people ought to take very, very seriously and not just buy into. I mean, just to elaborate on your point about eating disorders, I think what we have in this culture right now is the equivalent of what we would have if, for instance, public health authorities were alcoholics and didn't know it and were giving people advice about social drinking. If that was the situation, I'm sure they would say things like you ought to have 6 or 8 beers when you get home from work in the evening because it really takes the edge off the day. I mean, I think we're having a similar thing right now with weight in this culture in which people are saying, try to see the world through an anorexic lens because it's really worked for me.
And their whole focus is on behavior modification, and that's the buzzword. And quite often, it's their behavior that really needs to be modified and helped rather than the general public. But again, thank you very much. You did a perfect, an important public service. And as I said before, I don't think anyone in the health field would have done it because I think a graduate student would have been crucified by their professors, and someone else who was professional would have been crucified by his colleagues who have invested a great deal of money and most of their career in one philosophy.
Well, unfortunately, I think there's a lot to what you say, but you know, thank you for your kind words about the book.
You're welcome.
Right.
Thank you.
Let's come back here to someone in Urbana, I believe, line number 2. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi. Yeah, I think we do have a severe obesity crisis in the country, and people like your guest who inadvertently perpetrates this. For instance, he's referred to during today's talk as to a healthy lifestyle, and you really can't have a healthy lifestyle because healthy means in good health. What he really means is that we need a healthful lifestyle. And if you looked at that, if you ever saw that movie about Super Size Me, you had those Big Macs, and before the person would eat the Big Macs, he would show it to everyone, and everyone could see this healthy-looking Big Mac. But a healthy Big Mac is not healthful. And until our health educators can convince the public the difference between what is healthy and what is healthful, we are going to continue to have an obesity crisis.
Well, any comment on that?
Well, sure. I think a healthful lifestyle is a lifestyle that does not obsess unnecessarily on either weight or, for example, supposed junk food. Now, I'm not a proponent of going out and eating three supersized McDonald's meals a day any more than I'm a proponent of drinking a case of beer every day. If I drank a case of beer every day for a month, I'm sure I would have some very detrimental health effects from that. However, that does not mean that having a beer a day isn't a good thing. In fact, for the most part, it is. I think a healthful diet includes a mixture of foods, including sometimes foods that have plenty of fat and sugar in them for all kinds of reasons, because you need those substances, and also because one of the things about a healthful diet is a pleasurable diet. I don't think we should leave pleasure out of eating food. And by the way, this I have heard from a number of people that I'm supposedly increasing America's obesity epidemic by bringing a critical perspective onto what I see as our hysteria on this issue. Actually, I think that if you wanted to create a culture full of fat people, what you would do is you would do exactly what our public health authorities have been doing for several decades now, which is to create this kind of obsessive compulsive regard for thinness and this notion that everybody ought to be on a diet and that we ought to demonize certain foods. And then if you eat a Krispy Kreme donut, your head is going to explode, which is basically the kind of message we're getting from our public health authorities. Hey, if that made people thin, we would have solved the obesity epidemic a long time ago. One of the things that I'm recommending here is, why don't we try something different? After all, we've been doing what the health authorities in regard to this issue have been saying for decades now. And rather than making people thin, it's making people fat. Because one of the things that makes people heavier than they would be otherwise is precisely this diet culture, with all of its obsessionalism and with its tendency to create weight cycling in people, which, among other effects, does make people fatter than they would otherwise be.
And that is, there is clear evidence that doing that, losing weight, gaining it back, losing weight, gaining it back, and not only do when people gain it back, they often gain more than they had
right,
before.
Right, absolutely.
But there is clear evidence that that is indeed a bad thing.
Yeah, there's a lot of evidence that weight cycling is bad for health. And one of the things that you see over and over again in these studies is, if you take people of similar initial weight, the people who diet end up weighing more than the people who don't. So the weight loss industry is essentially creating the quote-unquote disease, which they supposedly cure with their useless and expensive and dangerous therapies.
Well, I get at least one more. Line 3 is next, I believe, in Urbana. Hello.
Yes, calling to argue the point that you think there's no health benefits from being not obese. I mean, that's just preposterous. You're not. It's not common sense, and it's not medically sound what you're saying. Indeed, people's blood pressure do go down when they're of an appropriate weight, and whether the tables are exactly right or not, it's not arguable that people are too heavy in general in this country. I mean, you can see it. You can see it in the children. You can see it when you go out to eat. And you can see the lifestyles that contribute to it. So it just makes, I mean, maybe the diet industry certainly does perpetuate it in a sense, but you can't throw out the logic of needing to eat healthy and have a healthy lifestyle in order to be healthy.
Well, I'm all for a healthy lifestyle. I'm all for being physically active. I'm all for eating a balanced, nutritious diet. I'm all for avoiding eating disordered behaviors, including things like dieting, which is essentially a form of eating disordered behavior.
So you have to restrict some caloric. You have to pay attention. You have to be a conscious eater and hold yourself accountable to a certain amount of calories or some kind of guidelines in order to eat within healthy parameters, given the choices that we have in this country and the usual choices that people make. for their diets.
Well, no, I disagree with that.
That's what dieting is.
No, I disagree with that because I think that focusing on caloric intake is essentially a way of being on the road to eating disordered behavior. If focusing on caloric intake made people healthier and thinner, again, you know, why would people be gaining weight in this country? I mean, that's what everyone is told to do.
You want to keep throwing in the parallels with having a couple of beers. Why should anybody stop at a couple of beers then? Why should anybody ever monitor themselves and try to monitor how much they drink if they're prone to over drinking?
Well, because over drinking is a disease called alcoholism. Being heavier than average is not a disease,
but it causes diseases.
There's a complex relationship between weight and health, and one of the things that is really tremendously exaggerated about all this is the notion that if you're heavier than average, you're going to be much more prone to, say, heart disease or cancer than you will be if you're thinner than average.
Bad knees and huffing and puffing in order to do any exercise, so you don't do any. I mean, there's a ton of reasons that people should not want to be overweight or obese, and that's why people diet, because they don't want the ill effects, not just of society looking at them.
No, that's actually quite untrue. It's not true. The main reason why people want to be thin in the society is because of comments like yours, because people who don't understand the science behind this.
Actually, I do understand it.
No, what you're doing is you're essentially perpetrating eating disordered patterns of thinking here. Does it actually help anybody to be told to cut their caloric intake for the purposes of making them thin? It certainly doesn't seem to make people thin. If dieting made people thin, there wouldn't be any fat people. What you're saying is everybody should continue to do the stuff that has been proven not to work and which makes people less healthy and less happy than they would be otherwise.
I'm going to have to jump in here. My apologies to the caller. I'm sure she would like to continue to talk with our guest, but we simply have to stop. We have used our time. There are going to be some opportunities, though, to hear more from him and to talk with him. A public lecture tonight at 7:30 dealing with these themes at the Illinois Program for Research in the Humanities, 805 West Pennsylvania. He'll be doing a book signing of his book, The Obesity Myth, at the Author's Corner of the Illini Union Bookstore at noon tomorrow, and then a couple of panel discussions, too. One Wednesday at 3 p.m., Thursday at 1 p.m., dealing with a lot of these issues. Again, that's at IPRH. So if you're interested, they're all open to the public. Our guest, Paul Campos, he's professor of law at University of Colorado. Thank you.
Thank you.
The program made possible in part by a grant from Birkenstock Concepts by Heel to Toe, downtown Urbana, for over 25 years, offering all sizes and widths of Birkenstocks. From clogs and sandals to work dress and sport shoes, Birkenstock Concepts offers repair and modification services and a certified podorthist and orthotist on staff. The show also made possible with support from the Art Mart in the Lincoln Square Mall, Urbana. The Art Mart is pleased to support public radio in East Central Illinois. That's it for us. I want you to stay tuned, though. Much more coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine. The host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Good morning. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll talk about Jonas Salk, his pursuit of the polio virus, and a weapon to fight it. Our guest will be journalist Jeffrey Kluger, author of Splendid Solution, Jonas Salk and the Conquest of Polio. That's at 106 Central Time this afternoon. Let's take a look at what's happening on the Chicago Board of Trade now. March wheat, 327, up 3.75. July wheat trading at 341.5, up 3.5. March corn, 205.5, unchanged. May, 213, down 1/4. July, 220, down 1/4. December, 234.25, down 1/2. March soybeans, 612, that up 3.5. May, 619.5, up 3.5. November, 609, down 1.